Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and I'm very excited about this conversation. I was going through the notes from our pre-call or our initial conversation, and I was like, oh, we talked about that. Oh, this is so exciting. This is going to be great. Oh my God. So I'm curious to see what kind of bubbles through here and what doesn't, and what's supposed to be in our conversation. And I'm very, very, very much delighted to welcome you, Jude Currivan.
Thank you, Amit. It's my great pleasure to be with you. I mean, we met in Iceland, which was a wonderful opportunity. And it's lovely to be with you now. So thank you for the invitation.
I tend to ask the hardest question first.
Fair enough.
I think, yes, just to get it over with and to let you define yourself as you see fit and not me doing that. So who are you, Jude Currivan?
Gosh, who am I? I'm a child of Gaia. I'm a co-evolutionary partner with the whole universe. I'm a gardener. I'm an ABBA fan. I'm also a cosmologist and planetary healer, futurist, best-selling, award-winning author, previously one of the most senior business women based in the UK, but internationally, work globally, and the co-founder of Whole Worldview, lots of other things, and a coal miner's daughter. And a coal miner's daughter. So that's a little bit of who I am.
Thank you. I'm curious to, because we spoke about a lot of things in our previous, we talked about sort of economics. We talked to some degree about unity quite a bit. We also talked about sort of the activist mindset and how that stance and relationship to the world has consequences or not. And we also talked a little bit about sort of the dance between the masculine and the feminine. And what would you, where does your curiosity lie today? Like what would be, what pulls you out of not, if it's not on that list as well, like what would pull you?
I'm sure we'll go down many channels of exploration today, but I guess what's really very much in my front and focus at the moment is what I refer to as a unitive narrative. You know, we're a storytelling species. We've told stories around campfires, hearths for many, many, many millennia, perhaps to the very dawn of what it means to be human. And we've had a narrative in the past ages, and we have a, in the past centuries, that's progressively become a narrative of separation and materialism. And so our behaviors tend to follow our narratives, which are themselves our worldview. They're the lens through which we see the world. So for me, we've come to a point, and without blame or shame, we've come to a point now where that paradigm, that worldview, that narrative of materialism and separation is existentially threatening to our entire survival, let alone thrival, let alone evolutionary potential, both as a species and in relationship with our planetary home, Gaia. So for me, what I'm really excited about is the lead. I'm a scientist and I'm also many other hats, but as a scientist, as a cosmologist, what's really exciting me now is that we have more and more compelling evidence that that old paradigm is essentially incomplete at the very least. So leading edge science across many scales, well, all scales actually of existence and many, many different fields of research, very wide ranging fields of research, are turning it on its head. And instead, they're converging with what I call universal wisdom teachings, spiritually based teachings, indigenous traditions, to reveal that our universe meaningfully exists, not accidentally or randomly, and purposefully evolves as a non-locally unified entity where we are inseparable from everything within it and where mind and consciousness aren't something we have, but literally what we in the whole world are. And because I can say that with such confidence, because I've studied this since I was a little girl. That's over six decades of discovery and inner and outer exploration on this. But what I'm really excited about is the evidence across many, many thousands of pieces of research, that when you join all the dots, this is what's emerging. And to such an extent that in 2022, late last year, the Nobel Prize was given in physics for decades-long research into the universal non-local unification of non-unified nature of our universe. And the Nobel isn't given for physics. It's not given for other than settled science that's conclusively proven, that's not contentious. So we now are at a threshold where all of this evidence is coming forward. And what it's doing is enabling us to write a new story, to actually come forward with a new and unitive paradigm. And it's new not because spirituality-based teachings have not told us this for decades and hundreds of years and thousands of years. It's new because of the scientific breakthroughs and discoveries and evidence. So we can now not just hope and have faith and trust in this, but have authentic hope and grounding. And what it can do, in my view, is it can underpin and frame a huge healing journey of remembering who we really are, an empowering journey of potential conscious evolution, and a transformational journey, because when we see the world, rather than through eyes of separation, we see it through a unitive lens, we behave differently. So that's what I'm excited about.
That's exciting. Yeah. I mean, one of those things that my mind skipped on a little bit as you were speaking was this, I mean, that the universe has meaning. It has its evolution towards evolving towards a purpose, or like it has a direction, so to say. And in one end of my circles, I'm used to hanging out with that type of thinking. And then something else kind of came in, whereas I got really curious. I'm like, how am I supposed to understand those words? Like, what does that actually mean?
Okay, it's such a foundational question. And it's only with many, many, many years of exploration, but now the evidence that I can say that, you know, I can share that perspective. And I'm not trying to convince anyone. What I am doing is, in my books, in my work, in all that I do, I'm sharing what has come forward. And then people can make their own minds up whether they feel there's a meaning and a purpose to our existence and this journey of our universe. So let's go back to the beginning. First of all, we now realize, and again, this is evidence-based, that the appearance of our universe, its energy and matter and space and time, those sort of 20th century pillars of science are real, but they're the appearance of our universe. They're not its most foundational reality. And we now understand that the appearance of energy, matter, and space-time arises and emerges from deeper levels of non-physical causation, of as not just as random data, but as meaningful information, digitized information that literally informs the entire appearance of our universe, from the smallest scale, what's known as the Planck scale, P-L-A-N-C-K, after Max Planck, who's one of the great pioneers of quantum physics. But the Planck scale is essentially the pixelation of the appearance of our universe. It's as small as to a proton, as a proton is to the entire universe. But it's the way in which the manifestation of our universe comes into being, its appearance comes into being. And it does so, and this is rather like a sort of a Rubik's Cube of physics. It's taking scientific evidence and discoveries across this huge scale of both existence and many fields of research to show that also our universe is essentially holographically manifest. In other words, its appearance is a projection of cosmic mind. It's not the less real. But nonetheless, it's rather like a great thought, as Sir James Jeans, a very eminent Edwardian scientist, spoke of. It's more a great thought than a great thing. And we now understand how that works when we take the sort of the foundation of cosmic mind, we might say God or Allah or great mystery, whatever we want to term it. And Einstein referred to it as cosmic mind, the infinite and eternal cosmic plenum from which these great thoughts arise. And ours arose, our universe arose 13.8 billion years ago in its holographically projected, manifested, meaningfully informed way, because you know all the signatures of this meaningful information we find from the fractal patterns within atoms when electrons cluster, through to molecules, through to planetary scale of river systems and meteorological patterns and the human systems. You know, we find the same patterns underlying the internet as we find underlying an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. We find the same patterns playing out in the frequency and destructive power of earthquakes as we do in the destructive power and frequency of human conflicts. We find that underlying the appearance of our universe are these what's called attractor basins of meaningful information that then arise as the appearance throughout all scales of our universe, from the most minute to the wholeness of it. We find, for example, the same patterns were discovered in 2017 by looking at what's known as the cosmic microwave background. It's basically relic radiation left over from 380,000 years after the beginning of our universe, when our universe, when space was expanding and time was flowing, but cooled down enough to be transparent to light. And when it became transparent to light, that relic radiation, which filled all of space then, fills all of space now as it's continued to expand, but it's been stretched to microwave frequencies. So it's called the cosmic microwave background, but it fills all of space. When a map of that was done in 2017, tiny temperature fluctuations were found throughout it, and they formed the beginnings of structure in the universe. But those tiny temperature fluctuations are patterned in exactly the same way as we find patterns in ecosystems, patterns in atomic clusters, patterns in scales of clusters of galaxies. This is throughout the whole of space, throughout the whole of our universe. So we're finding all what I'm sharing in terms of the meaningfully informed existence of our universe. But when I say too that it purposefully evolves, we need to go back to the very beginning and realize that 13.8 billion years ago, our universe didn't begin in what we were taught was a big bang. We know it wasn't big. That was just being facetious. We know it was minute. But if I ask you, I mean, you know, what comes to mind when I say bang?
Something that sound comes to mind and something that's spreading and expanding.
But also perhaps chaos, an explosion.
Chaos, yeah, sure, absolutely. Yeah? Yeah.
That isn't what it was at all. That isn't what it is at all. Instead, our universe began, yes, in its most minute state, but incredibly ordered and exquisitely, extremely fine-tuned. Fine-tuned to such an extent that it was able to embody with all of the laws of physics, which are really like relational algorithms guiding how its appearance not just exists but evolves, enabled it then to, from that first moment, evolve from its initial simplicity to ever greater levels of complexity and individual awareness, interdependence, interbeing. But when I wrote The Story of Gaia, which was my last book, which was really the story of our planetary home, but the story of our whole universe, when you go back, you realize the evidence is showing us that at each point in that evolutionary arc, there was preparation. In other words, what was the conditions enable those further steps to complexity to be undertaken? And those steps were not random. They were meaningful. They were guided by information, by meaningful information all the way through, whether it was from the first few minutes when, you know, you started to get the beginnings of not just hydrogen, which is the simplest element, but helium. And I always wondered, and this shows that I should have got out more when I was a kid, I always wondered why you needed helium, because I always follow Einstein's view that the universe is as simple as it can be, but no, simpler. And I add, to undertake its evolutionary purpose, because the reason helium was there, and helium's incredibly stable, so it's created in this very early time of the universe and just hung around for a couple of hundred million years, very stably, with hydrogen until the first stars formed. And then something wonderful happened, because in the heat, those temperatures in the middle of stars, a great alchemy began to occur, began to progress from the very simplest elements all the way to ever more complex elements. And it turns out that to actually transmute helium to carbon is a very, very resonant but quite difficult reaction to occur. It only works one time in every 2,500 goes at it, okay? But without that, what's called the triple alpha reaction, carbon couldn't have been formed, nor oxygen, nor nitrogen, nor heavier elements. We would not be here. That evolutionary progress would have stopped there and then. But the issue is that if there was just enough helium formed from the original hydrogen within stars, there wouldn't be enough helium in the mix to actually enable that reaction to occur. The universe needed that primordial helium to be in the mix for that ongoing progress. And that's just one example. There are many, many, many others all the way through to this moment and ongoing, where the purposeful predisposition, pre-preparation for further complexity was there. So, for example, before our planetary system came into being, all of the prebiotic complex molecules that make up you and me and plants and animals and you know, were there in interstellar clouds of gas and dust. All the ice was there before our planetary system came into being, ready, but it couldn't go further. Because although conditions were perfect to get it to that point, to get it to that threshold, they weren't enough. They weren't benevolent enough. They weren't nurturing enough to move it forward. That's why planets, rocky planets, water planets, were then the next stage as part of planetary systems. And we now know, when we look out into space, we're finding more and more and more, not just planets, but water, rocky planets, like our own planetary home, Gaia, and in what's called a Goldilocks zone, far enough from their central stars, not too warm, not too cold, and with water. This is what I mean by an evolutionary purpose. And I could literally, there are hundreds and thousands of profound examples that just build this case. Our universe doesn't just exist and evolve, meaningfully exist and evolve as a unified entity, but exists to purposefully evolve from simplicity to ever greater complexity.
And I was just reading a book by Carol Sanford.
Yes.
And one of the things that she does in that, she outlines a framework around results, outcomes, and effects. And she's proposing that effects are things that we cannot necessarily see from the initial action, but rather just sort of looking back. we don't know what the effects of this particular conversation could be. You know, maybe it could launch my podcast out into outer space, or it could be, I mean, you know, who knows, like what would actually be the effects of this thing. But at the moment, we're doing certain things, and at the end of the conversation, we know that we're going to have had a conversation, and that's a result. You know, and I'm definitely sort of tickled and inspired by it already. So, but she just makes that distinction, and it kind of makes me curious about. it makes me curious about sort of the maybe the inevitability it's easy to hear, I think, or at least for me, it sometimes escapes. I'm like, oh, this is the only explanation, or like the only outcome that was possible, or the only result that was possible. But I don't think you're saying that at all. But there was something around, I wanted to double click on that. And then I wanted to loop back into information, which was, I heard you use, and I have this sense that it's a different way of using that word than I would normally, that I've been normally sort of classically trained to think about it.
I'm wondering if
you want to unpack some of those. Yeah, let's see.
Well, let's talk about, I love Carol's work. And, you know, it also reminds me of a saying by Kierkegaard, the great sort of Danish philosopher. We live life forwards and we understand it backwards, which I think is a really beautiful way of putting this. Directionality, the sort of directionality of our universe that I'm describing, is not inevitability. What it is an arc of simplicity to greater complexity, yes? An individuated awareness, considering our universe, is a great thought, where mind and consciousness aren't something we have, but literally what we in the whole world are. Then that wholeness is a both and. So within space-time, as space expands and time flows forward, there is an arrow of time. The past contributes to the present, which contributes to the future, but it doesn't determine the future, other than the laws of physics playing out through the whole life cycle of our universe. You know, it's not that inevitability, for example, that we will survive as a species. It's not the inevitability that Gaia was able to survive and thrive and nurture, you know, this complexity of her, what I call her entire Gaia sphere, but into biological complexity over, you know, 4 billion years. You know, when the asteroid came in 66 million years ago and the dinosaurs were destroyed, what actually that did was it enabled a whole next wave of complexity, that of the mammals, to come through. But if that asteroid had been 10 times as large, then Gaia herself may not have survived. So, you know, there isn't an inevitability in this, but there is a directionality in it and a potentiality in it. I'd like to make that point. And also that within space-time, within our universe, this great thought, which has a beginning and you know, is more and more, we're realizing, is finite in its life cycle. It also exists and evolves as a unified whole. So within space-time, there is this directionality, there is this arc of both meaning and purposeful evolution, and there is a causation, yeah? And that is what a lot of folks talk about when they talk about entropy, and we can come back into entropy, because this is not about order to disorder. That's a misunderstanding. We're now realizing and restating entropy in informational terms as entropy. When we do that, we realize it's beyond being the energetics states of a system, it's the informational content of a system. So the entropy of our universe began in its lowest level at the very beginning of our universe, of space-time. As space has expanded and time's flowed ever since, the entropy has increased ever since. The information content of our universe has increased ever since. And there is a flow to that, and there's a progression to that. And it's a both and. Our universe knows itself in its entirety because it is non-locally unified. So that's why we can bring into this emergent understanding synchronicities, non-local perceptions such as our intuition, telepathy, precognition. Supernormal superpowers that are natural to us because we ourselves are microcosmic co-creators of our universe. It's not an either or, it's a both and. And this is really, really key. So that's really how this is describing. And that's why I love Carol's work, but I also feel that many, many other researchers are now coming to the same understanding, not just cosmologists, but also evolutionary biologists, systems theorists, you know, folks across this wide, wide range of research. When they're at the leading edge, I think for most of them, they found this, but they're not sure how to position it or place it, because that's not been their journey to this point. For me, this is a lifelong journey. For me, this is the universe as I've understood and experienced it from I was 4 years old. But it's only now that the science is able to stand alongside the wisdom teachers that guided me on this journey to show this much grander and wondrous perspective. Hmm.
So that's a nice bridge to back to where you started, maybe, or forward to where you started, in terms of that unified narrative. Because there's a way. I love thinking about these things, and usually when I fly off in this way, or like sort of sail away into these sort of levels of abstractions or over there and way back then, and like here's the, you know, these grand narratives or grand arcs, I lose people. So I'm kind of wondering like how, what does a grounding narrative for this look like? What is a narrative that starts giving us the right stances, if you will, to be that unity or to be that mind consciousness?
Well, first thing I would say is that when I co-founded Whole World View in 2017, it was not just to understand, it was to experience and embody, to serve, not just the understanding, but to serve the experiencing and embodying of unitive awareness. And the unitive narrative that you know, a group of us at the Evolutionary Leaders came up with, we did it from a very grounded perspective, because we were members of what's called the SDG Thought Leaders Synergy Circle. And these are over 100 folks who have worked with the United Nations for many, many years. And many of them involved in the development of the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs, and Agenda 2030. And the SDGs and Agenda 2030 are there as responses to our behaviours, that our behaviours arise from a worldview of separation. Yeah, and these change makers realize that with that worldview, with that outlook, that the SDGs could never be implemented, that Agenda 2030 could never be successful, because it was coming from a siloed perspective, a worldview, a perspective of behaviors and organizations of separation. So we came together, and it became very clear in those early convenings and those early gatherings that what we needed was a new and unitive narrative to underpin and frame unified approaches, whether it's unitive economics, unitive education, unitive justice, unitive governance, whatever it may be. Because when we see through a lens of our worldview, we behave accordingly. So when we see through a lens of separation, we behave in separate ways. Conflicts are natural. Exploitation is natural. Trauma is natural, actually, because of that, because we're not naturally separate. We know at the deepest sense of our being, we are not separate. And yet what we're taught, our organizations, they're all actually based on not even 20th century science. They're based on 19th century mechanistic science that's prevailed through to now. So we have 21st century technology and 19th century mechanistic science, and therefore all the structures, organizations that we have accordingly. So the point is that when we can now understand all of this evidence is turning that old paradigm on its head, it's actually almost an aha moment for a lot of folks, because it's actually saying, you know, it's actually validating what so many in their own inner journeys of remembering and discovery are revealing to them. And what we say in the unitive narrative, and we, you know, I can give you, Amit, the links on this, is that this reconciles heart and head. This reconciles, you know, our inner being and outer doing. You know, we can move beyond the schizophrenia that that we've lived in, we can bring ourselves into whole being and a realization that we intimately, innately belong with our planetary home and with our entire universe. And realizing, and this is another, I think, reason why I felt to use the term big breath as opposed to big bang, and an ongoing big breath, because ever since I was small, I've really honored the teachings of ancient India, the Vedic tradition of ancient India, and their incredible writings of the Vedas, and especially the Upanishads, which are the treatises on philosophy and spirituality. And what I was reading when I was 6, 7, 8 years old in those writings, what I was already directly experiencing. And all the way through, when I went to Oxford University and did my master's in physics and quantum physics and cosmology, you know, that we were getting the clues there, but I was not being taught. Those clues of that deeper nature understanding were pushed to one side. And it's only now, after all these years later, that the evidence is now so compelling that I can share today and write about in so many ways. But this also now, in a unitive narrative, which was adopted by these thought leaders. So the SDG Thought Leader Circle formally adopted the unitive narrative. It also values the complementary attributes of feminine and masculine. It literally values and converges with universal wisdom teachings, indigenous teachings, traditions, all that I mentioned earlier. And to the extent that the thought leaders now are bringing forward this perspective, this unitive perspective to all the work they do with the United Nations, and including late last year, 17 UN-affiliated organizations, NGOs, came together on this basis and approached the United Nations to form what's called a formal thematic cluster based on unitive approaches. And for the first time in its 75-year history, the United Nations formally adopted the unitive thematic cluster. And that means that it has access to all the policy making, all the conversations, all the explorations, really, really grounding this. But that's one example. The reason, though, that I also talk about the big breath is to sort of say that our universe breathes through each and every one of us. It's not out there. It is out there, but it's also in here. Every breath we take, essentially, the universe, after 13.8 billion years of its evolution, is breathing through us. And again, that relates to ancient Indian tradition. Prana is breath, but it's also spirit. So this is intimate for each and every one of us. This isn't something, you know, this is far, far, far more than a new scientific revolution. This is a revolution in our remembering of who we really are. This is an invite from the universe to evolve, to consciously evolve, to become its co-evolutionary partner. And at Whole Worldview, we talk about acting local, feeling global, and thinking cosmic.
Ah, beautiful. That's interesting. I mean, it's funny to hear you speak of these things, because that has been those are the words that I tend to use about my own journey since I sort of consciously started to pursue some sort of spiritual practice or inner practice, so to say, over the past, you know, 7 or so years, where it's been really a feeling of sort of coming home. It's been a feeling of relaxation. I've been using words like I'm starting to come into my potentiality, like sort of to fill out the bigger circle that I thought that I once was. It's like there are all of those things that are there, and a lot of the curiosity, and maybe this brings us into that stance of the activism or the fight that we also touched upon in the first conversation that we had, because I'm feeling that there's also so much of people that I have these conversations with that are in this field that seem to be looking at the same thing, but they come into it with there's that fight, there's that sort of activist. There's a emphasis on the I need to do this. There's a lot of emphasis on the saving, maybe. There's a lot of emphasis of the changing of things as they are. Like there's a specific maybe it's like a boundary that's put up or something. Like there's something that they're pushing, that seems to be pushing against, you know. Whereas I resist the word right, but for me the liberation has lied in relaxing rather of like becoming smaller and like in some way it's like that counterintuitive movement of shrinking that has allowed me to expand. It's the mechanics of it feels very odd, yet the experience of it, like I mean maybe you understand, like you have that feeling too, so you might know what I'm talking to, but you know, words aren't really doing the job right now. But I'm curious about sort of why, how, I'm just curious about that energy. I'm so curious about why it's so prevalent, that sort of self-fulfilling energy of the fight, the fighting, like that type of pushing against something, why that is the path of so many, which to me is, at least the way that I understand you explaining it right now, it seems like it's still in that separation or separated narrative. So I know you've thought about a lot about this, so maybe you can figure out a question among all of those words.
I have, and I really have, you know, I think the journey we've been on as a human species has been amazing. I mean, I've been a student of history and prehistory. And pre-her story. My PhD is in anthropological archaeology. Mm. And so what I researched was the transition from being hunter-gatherers in what's called the Middle Stone Age or Mesolithic to being pastoralists and farmers in the New Stone Age or Neolithic. And what that really meant in terms of how we saw ourselves and the wider world, how we experienced. And the reason it's anthropological archaeology is it's not just about artifacts, although they're very important. It's about the relationships that we can get from many pieces of evidence of how we related with our landscapes, you know, the cosmologists that people had when they started to create monuments. I'm very fortunate. I live near a wonderful place called Avebury in England, which is also part of the World Heritage Site that includes Stonehenge. And Britain is full of Neolithic monuments, but they give us a lot of clues. And from my own work and sensitivity, you know, I've sort of tried to commune with the ancestors and really try to gain some more insights. But it was a change in worldview, and it came at the time we pretty much know very peacefully. But as we came further on that journey, there were conflicts and there was more exploitation, there was more inequalities as the, you know, Neolithic moved into the Bronze Age, and there was more of a masculine hierarchy came forward, more and more inequalities. And therefore there was both fighting for and fighting against mm-hmm. what was coming through. And we see that as well in the last 2,500 years with what's called the Axial Age. Because 2,500 years ago, some incredible ideas entered the stream of human consciousness. You know, many of the religions came forward at that time over a period of hundreds of years, actually, from Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Zoroastrianism. And with them brought huge social changes, again, fought against. Mm. And we're now at a point, it seems to me, that with all that we've shared in our conversation today, and this unitive understanding now coming forward and converging with ancient and indigenous wisdom teachings and spiritual-based teachings, we have an opportunity to remember that we're inseparable. And it seems that a lot of the activism that I have great compassion for, I understand, but is in still a separation-based perspective. And it is about fighting for or fighting against or saving, you know. And when we can wake up and begin to grow up, and more people are, into this unitive perspective, grounded, authentically grounded in a unitive narrative, and with that, act local and feel global and think cosmic, then activism is sort of itself evolves, it seems to me. And instead of a for or against, we're a with. We're an invitation to be with what brings us together rather than what separates us. And what brings us together, it seems to me, is a realization of our innate unity expressed in radical diversity. We are each unique and yet we are whole. And when we realize that, we can have great differences of views. And, you know, we can also and should, in my view, be discerning against behavior that is not for life, but against life. You know, but we can do so in a way that invites, as much as we possibly can, a coalition of the willing to work through our differences and say sometimes, well, I don't agree with you, but I accept and honor your and my right to have these differences. But how can we come together to most effectively look after what we all care about? What can we all agree on that we stand for together? And therefore, how can we? I talk about us coming together to link up, lift up, level up, and light up. But it's from this underpinning and framing of unity and unity and diversity. And I think the other thing to do to finish to say is that even beyond unity and diversity, for a number of years now, I've not quite been at ease with that terminology, because I've found that sometimes a perspective of diversity also excludes or brings in folks that it's right to bring in, but the way they're brought in doesn't resonate, doesn't feel appropriate. So I go beyond diversity and even beyond inclusion to belonging. Because what we're realizing is that we all belong. And when you belong, you don't need to be invited in, which is just as well, because, you know, I always say when I was at school, I was the last person to be invited onto the netball team because I'm very short. my whole life, you know. But we belong. There is a realization that we belong with each other. We belong with our planetary home, Gaia. And we belong to our entire and whole universe. So it's an invitation to remember that and to come together and together consciously evolve, because the adventure that awaits us, Amit, it seems to me, is the most profound adventure of our entire human story so far, if we accept that invitation. And to do so, the invitation, the RSVP requires us to remember to remember the realization of who we really are.
The dress code is come as you are, right?
Totally come as you are.
I really like what you're pointing to here, because I think the way that I've thought about it as well is, and the more that I've, you know, so the further I've gone in terms of looking out there, the more called and the more capable I feel to actually bring it home and do it here. Because I find sometimes that, or at least initially, as I was kind of making my way into this terminology and very much coming in with a perspective that I wanted to change or save the world, and that, you know, that was wrong and that was wrong and that was wrong, and I could point to all these things, but to bring them home and to do it, whatever I think is right, to bring that home to my closest relationships, to be able to behave and be and act that way and be that person with my wife and with my daughters, that has, you know, and starting to really be able to do that. I mean, although it's simple, it's so not easy for the nervous system and the narratives. Like, it's just difficult, like, because of the history that I have, the programming that I carry. I resist a little bit the word programming, but nonetheless. And so, I mean, that's kind of the, because now I hang out anyways in sort of world changer circles, people that have these grand ambitions for changing everything and everyone at once. And I'm sometimes worried that we haven't mastered that act locally aspect. And I'm curious, you know, sometimes I feel like if you can't act locally with the people that are around you that you see every day, then if they don't trust you to change with you, then why focus so much out there? Or what, you know, what it doesn't seem like the right soil to nurture this change in, because you have to, as you say, like it is about our being, be the change or whatever, like all of those platitudes that we kind of shrug off, but meaning them quite literally. But it's also a high bar to set for people to, that with our programming, with the society and the culture that we are steeped in, to actually relax to that degree that we are consistent. We are consistently ourselves in a way, or we are who we were meant to be, or something like that. So if we talk practically for the individual that feel a resonance here, what are the practices or approaches or stances? Like how do I start sort of, you know, relaxing? So I see this dough that I put on the table and like it was in the shape, it was like in the bread basket, and then I take it out and put it on the table and it kind of goes like it just floats out, you know, it becomes bigger but less shaped, and to then take a new shape probably, hopefully. But how do you allow for that? How do you start that, you know, floating out?
I love that. I love the dough going shh.
Yeah, right.
If it was me, it would fall off the edge of the table, to be honest, because right. I'm so messy. My husband says I'm the messiest person he knows, and he's right. I would, there's so much in what you shared then that is important. I think for me, and it's a personal choice, I have never been ambitious. It sounds weird. I've all my life, and I realize again with the Kierkegaard and Carol Sanford perspective of looking backwards, I've showed up, and this is my mum, by the way, because my mum brought me up like this, show up and get out of the way. And if I was ever getting too highfalutin she'd just say, get over yourself, just get over yourself, show up and get out of the way and do your best. And that's something I try to do each and every day, regardless of where I am, who I'm with, what I'm doing. The other thing she taught me, and it is so lovely, because the more we're having this conversation, the more conversations I have, the more I realize how much I sound like her. But she taught me, she also taught me to treat everybody the same and to honor everybody. As I mentioned, I'm a coal miner's daughter, I'm a coal miner's granddaughter. My dad actually died when I was 10. So my mum brought myself and my younger brother up, and she brought us up with love. That was it, with love and honesty. Things she said to me, she said, do the right thing regardless of the cost. That stayed with me all my life. Treat everybody the same and with honour. That's stayed with me all my life. Whether it's a king or a queen or a homeless person, treat everybody with honor and respect. You know, see them through the eyes of love. See them through the eyes of they're you in a different body, in a different life, in that sense. So that's where we can all start. We can all start, it seems to me, by asking ourselves, what would love do? And you said something. You said it's really simple, but it's not easy. And the number of times I've said that to folks, it's simple, but it's not easy. But that's the case. But it's a question of, are we willing to listen to that simplicity and step up, even though it's not easy? And we can do that in tiny baby steps but it's something to do in my perspective every day. You know, it's not to do on Sundays or you know, high holidays. It's to do it every day. And as you say, it's with the folks around us. It's the folks we come across, strangers every day. Whatever it may be, it truly is, in whatever way, act local. Feel global, think cosmic. Yes, because it's not an either or, it's a both. It's an all and. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And some days, you know, when I look up at the stars and it's very easy to think cosmic. And when I'm down the supermarket or cleaning the bathrooms out, perhaps less so. But, you know, over many, many years now, all three play within me all the time. And naturally, it's not a one or t'other or yes or no or this or that. It's all of them, because all of them are intrinsically the wholeness of who we are.
Yeah, there's something to that. Interbeingness or the interaffordance that they carry. I mean, it is that sort of the whole grain of sand, like the grain of sand that holds the mystery of the entire universe. I mean, there, when you start sensing into these perhaps large, perhaps really small questions, I mean, they appear everywhere. That's what I find. I mean, in terms of, it kind of speaks to that holographicness as well.
Absolutely, because the whole is in every part. And every part is a constituent of the whole. You know, again, ancient Indian tradition has a beautiful concept of Indra's net for the nature of reality, where, you know, reality is comprised of a myriad of jewels, and each jewel has many different facets, and each facet reflects every other facet, and they're connected by golden threads of light. I mean, how beautiful is that? It is the cosmic hologram. This is, as we're finding now, as we're rediscovering, but as we're discovering now at the leading edge of science, is the nature of reality.
And it brings me to say also this, let's see if that's actually correct or if it's just I have this experience right now that a lot of the polarities that I perceive, if I can address them as parallaxes instead, it sort of, it becomes much more fun. It's like just different perspectives of the same thing. And my job, when I really don't understand anyone, is to actually look for that, assume the belonging, and look for the common ground. Like look for why that position makes sense, you know, beyond straw or steel manning or whatever, but rather just really feel into that position, why it does make perfect sense for them to hold that position. And so it becomes more of a parallax.
Yeah, and I remember us having this conversation about the difference between paradox, because I think you said something about, but it can be very paradoxical. And I said, well, maybe if you consider it as parallax, and parallax is literally, as you say, it's seeing the whole from a different perspective. It somehow softens it. It softens that perception of duality or polarity or paradox into a sense of, oh, maybe. And I would say, though, that doesn't, for me, that doesn't prevent me discerning behavior that is detrimental, that is harmful, because I feel that's really important. But I don't judge it. I more sort of have a discernment about it and then look to find ways of how to soften it, how to ease it. And sometimes that's, you know, that a person may be in a perspective themselves where they just don't want to be part of a reconciliation or a coalition or a whatever it may be, but at least we can offer the compassion and you know, in a discernment of that, without heading back into the old duality-based duality-based judgment.
There is this, actually, when you say that about sort of discernment and especially when you spoke to harm, I find that interesting because it, like, what I haven't really thought this before. So let's see if it works out. But, you know, one way of looking at trauma and the way that I understand it, that the people that have studied that deeply, is that it's like an overload of the system, that there is it's something that exceeds your capacity, so to say. So part of it gets shut down, part of it might get stuck, and you might have to kind of, in a way, it's like this keeping of stuff to deal with later. So you can kind of survive and move on to live another day. And then in the animal world, you do the shaking. Like, you have these strategies for metabolizing the trauma, for moving it out of your body. And some of those we seem to have forgotten, or we're not culturally sort of as astute or good at dealing with it. I'm curious about, because the context here too is that I've recently started doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is, you know, it's a grappling thing, and in a way it's violent. I mean, it's we're trying to strangle one another. And what I just realized when you said harmful was that, in a way, that seems to also have to do with it relates to my capacity in a way, because if I wrestle with someone that wants to do me harm, that has that doesn't have that filter of play or whatever, but actually tries to destroy me, I mean, there is a way that things that they could do to me as a newbie in this space would be very harmful, versus 10 years down the line, if I actually continue this practice and I get very skilled, I mean, they wouldn't be so it's like, it seems to have a similar quality as the trauma concept. It could also apply to the harmfulness. So it relates to the capacity, which I think is interesting in terms of when we're discerning, because then it's not about good or bad. It's just about how it relates to the other me's, the other self's capacity to deal with that particular behavior at that particular moment, and how we can kind of help each other metabolize or stand in relationship to it and learn from it, rather, so that we can unfold. And maybe it gives us more complexity then, or not. I mean, there's something in that jumble.
No, there is. There really is. And I think that, you know, for trauma, for many years, I worked with folks in a sort of psycho-spiritual release of trauma. So again, I've not just studied it, but I've been experientially involved in a, you know, really deep understanding of what it's about. And I've come to the perspective that the trauma that we collectively hold, both personally and collectively, is really associated with what I call our dis-ease of separation.
Mm.
Because if we, you know, if we have this worldview, this perspective, this lens of separation, and we act accordingly, going back to earlier in our conversation, you know, we come to, you know, we inequalities, inclusions, exclusions, conflicts are all sort of behaviors, as it were, of a worldview of separation. And all of those behaviors initiate not just, you know, trauma as a sort of an experiential aspect of being human, where we can shake it off or we can move beyond it. And indigenous traditions have very good ways of moving beyond trauma and releasing it. Rites of passage, rituals, releases, you know, that they are very wise in the way that they deal with the, you know, the ups and downs and the challenges and the traumas of life. It seems to me, though, as we've progressively and collectively moved into a worldview of separation, our collective trauma has become chronic.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gone through processes where we've either denied it or we've just got on with it or we've done whatever of it. And it seems to me that we've now come as part of this existential moment of choice, not just to remember who we really are and have the potential to consciously evolve, but from this perspective of unity in belonging, to also recognize and release and heal that collective chronic trauma. And that takes many forms. And there are many, many therapeutic modalities now. But there's a progressive, not just recognition of this collective trauma, but an understanding of why. And again, without blame or shame.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not about going round and round and round again. It's saying we're at this point now where we have an opportunity that we've never had as a species before. Are we going to accept the invitation of the universe and take this great opportunity to heal and to evolve? And healing our collective trauma from this perspective of remembering who we really are, as you so beautifully put it, is an absolutely vital aspect, crucial aspect, if we are to be able to consciously evolve. Because otherwise we're trying to drag all this luggage with us, and we cannot do this, we cannot do that. And I think a lot of that is played out, not all of it, of any rest, but certainly some of it is played out in activism and the way that that's been approached.
I'm exercising some discernment. I saw a tangent here that I don't know if I can responsibly bring up, because that might spur us off into another. But maybe I will, actually, because it might not be a thing at all. But what felt like was that another way to look at the trauma might be that it's actually keeping us from that direction of the universe, sort of to be able to complexify further, to actually to be able to come together, to become sort of that. I mean, there are all of these ideas around us becoming a superorganism, or like how we can sort of coordinate with one another in more intimate ways, and so that we can sort of share also our individual consciousness more tangibly, so to say, that we organize in larger entities. And in a way, I see that the trauma seems to be the thing that's kind of holding us back there. And then where my mind went was that, like silicon-based beings, they don't have, the AI, quote unquote, they don't seem to have the same trauma necessarily that we do. So like, how does that, what's the right use of words here? How does the trauma influence our evolutionary fittedness to, or like what, something like that, towards this complexification of the universe? I'm just, there seemed to be something very large at stake in terms of metabolizing the trauma when I heard you speak to it. And I was trying to put words to that, and I, you know, there might be other tangents that are more relevant to do that in. But yeah.
It's a huge question, and it's probably another conversation, actually, in terms of the potential for what I call allied intelligence rather than artificial intelligence, and the direction we might go forward. I really do think that's another really huge conversation. But for me, it seems to me we've really hardly gone beneath the surface of the potentiality as being as human beings. Yeah. We have such an innate soul to us, our consciousness, the whole history of our universe to this point is embodied within us. Yeah, we have supernormal superpowers that we're hardly really, moving into, such as our intuition, our ability to telepathically connect in group consciousness, not to become homogenous, to retain our uniqueness.
Yeah.
To retain our uniqueness, rather like unique cells within a 37 trillion cell body. This is our opportunity, and to, at this moment of potentiality, to give it away to technology just seems to me personally an incredible abdication of the evolutionary purpose that we've been invited to be part of and invited to become co-evolutionary partners with. So that's my perspective on this. And so, for me, the trauma is both, it is very, very heavy within us. It's arisen in great degree by this dis-ease of separation. I feel it can be healed in a wonderful amount. And there's something that I recall when we're saying this, to make our enemies our friends is one of the greatest bridges that we can cross over. And our enemies are primarily, not always, but primarily, because of that perception of separation.
Mm-hmm.
This is such a large discussion, and I it really deserves a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
I do feel it's vital, both as releasing the levels, the depths of our collective trauma, and appreciating why we hold it and how we can release it. Is key to our ability to go forward together.
Thank you. Is there something else present to you that relates to what we've been speaking about, that fits here, that should be here to make it a whole.
Yeah, just to perhaps to complete our conversation today, to be continued, I hope. I mentioned earlier, you know, I always ask myself in any call, what would love do? But I'm also very much sharing a perspective that our universe isn't just a living and evolving universe. It's also a loving universe. And by that, I don't mean fluffy bunnies, but I mean that the innate relationability of every aspect of our universe, the inseparability of every part with the whole and the whole with every part, is essentially the definition of love. And so for me, our universe is a benevolent, loving, inviting, exciting place to be human and to evolve to what our next steps of what it means to be human and perhaps what it means to be Gaian really is there for us to say yes to.
Beautiful. And so if people want to dive deeper into your work or interact with you, or how and where do they do that?
Probably the easiest is to go to www.wholeworld-view.org, which is wholeworld-view.org. And we have loads of resources there, lots of podcasts, details of my books, but also what, you know, is happening with all of our global partners who are also very much coming from this perspective of unity and unifiability.
Yeah, I'll put the link in the show notes as well for those that want to click further. And thank you so much for taking the time for this conversation. It's just wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for all you're doing. And yes, it's not easy, but it is simple.